were orchestrated by our own leaders, and that they did this to provide the justification, the fear, and the funding for the so-called war on terror, which would be used as a pretext for enlarging the empire. I will illustrate this point with one of the most brazen examples of the use of 9/11 to get funding. Shortly before the current Bush administration took office, about a year before, a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses was published by an organization called the Project for the New American Century, founding members of which included Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld. This document focused primarily on getting more tax monies allocated for the technological transformation of the U.S. military, with the centerpiece of this technological transformation being the U.S. Space Command's project to weaponize and thereby control space. Because this transformation of the U.S. military will be very expensive, the document said, it will probably proceed very slowly unless America suffers some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. It is interesting that then on the night of 9/11 itself, President Bush reportedly wrote in his diary, "The Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today." In any case, earlier that evening, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was on message. We might assume he would have been disoriented by the fact that the Pentagon had just, under his watch, suffered an unprecedented attack. Instead, he was ready to use the attacks to obtain more money for the U.S. Space Command. He had just before taking office, in fact, chaired the commission about the U.S. Space Command, popularly known as the Rumsfeld Commission. That evening of 9/11 itself, in front of television cameras, Rumsfeld berated Senator Carl Levin, then chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying, "Senator Levin, you and other Democrats in the Congress have voiced fear that you simply don't have enough money for the large increases in defense that the Pentagon is seeking, especially for missile defense. Does this sort of thing convince you that an emergency exists in this country to increase defense spending?" The strategy worked. Congress immediately appropriated an additional $40 billion for the Pentagon. Since then, furthermore, the president has gotten every additional appropriation he has sought for the so-called war on terror. Besides being a rousing success in obtaining increased spending for military purposes, 9/11 also provided the pretext for putting many military bases in Central Asia. Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, had said that doing so would be crucial for maintaining American primacy, partly because of the huge oil reserves around the Caspian Sea. Indeed, the Project for the New American Century may have gotten its idea that a new Pearl Harbor would be helpful from this book. Brzezinski, explaining that the American public had supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, suggested that Americans today would support the needed military operations in Central Asia only in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. And indeed, thanks to the attacks of 9/11, the Bush administration was able to carry out its plans to attack Afghanistan, a plan that we now know had been formulated several months before 9/11. The White House now has a friendly government in Afghanistan, and the Pentagon has military bases there and in several of the other countries in Central Asia. We also know that the intention to invade Iraq existed long before 9/11, and that this intention was based on imperial designs not discussed with Saddam's wickedness. In the Project for the New American Centuries 2000 document, we read, "While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein." The U.S. military is now intending to build several permanent bases in Iraq, which has the world's second largest known supply of oil reserves. The attacks of 9/11 again provided the pretext, as the Bush administration deceived a majority of the American people into believing that Saddam was connected with Osama bin Laden and even directly responsible for the attacks of 9/11. I suggested earlier that seeing the true connections between 9/11 and the Global Domination Project helps us understand how fully this project reflects fanaticism based on a deeply perverted value system. This is a value system that is diametrically opposed to the value systems on which all the great religious and moral traditions of the world have been based. These traditional value systems say that we should not covet, steal, and murder, that we should make sure that everyone has the necessary means for a decent life. But our government's project for global domination is carried out in the name of the haves of the world who want still more, even if it means killing hundreds of thousands of people and letting millions more die every year because of starvation and other poverty-related diseases. We can now see furthermore that some political and military leaders are so fanatically infected with these perverted values that they are willing to kill thousands of their own citizens, then endlessly use a deceptive account of these terrorist attacks to justify a war on terror, in the name of which they claim the right to do virtually anything they wish, ignoring all principles of international law and morality. Turn now, finally, to the question, how should religious people respond to 9/11 and the American Empire? My discussion of this question must be very brief, consisting merely of four suggestions. First, discover and then speak the truth. I would suggest that religious people should, if they have not done so already, study about both 9/11 and the American Empire to see if they find the claims I have made here true. If they do, then they should do everything they can to make others aware of these facts. Second, create new means to spread the truth. It is clear that the mainstream press in America is complicit in the cover-up of the truth about the American Empire in general and 9/11 in particular. For example, my second book, which exposes many outrageous lies, has not been reviewed by a single mainstream newspaper, magazine, television station, so on. There are, of course, alternative publications, both in print and on the internet, that seek to expose the truth about the American Empire. Most of these, however, fail to deal with 9/11. And most of them are indifferent to or even hostile to religion. So they do not provide effective organs to communicate with religious communities. Perhaps the most important thing that religious groups concerned with getting the truth about 9/11 out could do is to create new means of communication, means through which the contrast between the values of the religious traditions and the values of the Global Domination Project can be made clear. On this basis, an ecumenical religious movement to oppose the Global Domination Project partly by exposing the truth about 9/11, might be formed. Third, formulate proposals for subverting the global domination project. As such a movement begins to form, it will need to decide rather concretely how to go about trying to subvert the global domination project. Another thing we need from religious thinkers of the various traditions, therefore, are proposals for how to do this. I will soon be publishing, I hope, my own proposal, which is centered around the idea of global democracy. Other people will favor different proposals. But I stress the importance of having proposals from religious thinkers. It is probably only such proposals, drawing explicitly on the moral principles of the religious traditions, that will have the power to move large numbers of people around the world. Fourth, form alliances with other moral non-governmental organizations, generally called NGOs. I have emphasized that it is important for representatives from the various religious traditions to join forces. Indeed, my motto is, religions of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your impotence. But it is essential at the same time for these religious groups to forge alliances with what we can call the other moral NGOs of the world. Whether they are working for human rights, for peace, for ecological sustainability, or some related cause, the moral principles that motivate these NGOs are diametrically opposed to the values of the Global Domination Project. By emphasizing the moral principles that we have in common, organizations that are and are not explicitly religious can join forces in opposing that radically immoral project. I will close with the observation that insofar as Americans participate in this anti-imperial movement, their activities will be deeply patriotic because they will be seeking to call our nation back to its moral ideals, which stand diametrically opposed to the values implicit in the Global Domination Project. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Okay, first one, these are pretty random actually, because as I said, they're all good. My 15-year-old daughter wanted to be here, but she's in a Spanish test tomorrow. Her question is, the U.S. military is running out of troops. A draft seems to be in the offing, but probably wouldn't be accepted by the people without another 9/11 type event. A WMD attack, perhaps. Do you see signs of this coming?
That's a very frightening thought coming from a 15-year-old, isn't it? Knows what's going on. Because the problem is, as she suggests, if a draft is started, then we do have Vietnam. And that's what they learned. If you have a draft, then you get movements on university campuses that get a lot of publicity, and they don't want that. So they've tried using high-tech technology, but boy, when you invade and occupy, you need a lot of troops, as they learned. So they tried mercenaries, but the mercenaries from the other countries are mostly going home now, so what are we going to do? So I'm afraid she's right that the thought of another new Pearl Harbor may be an option.
Perish the thought.
Perish the thought.
Okay, next, what is your opinion of Mike Rupert's work in Crossing the Rubicon, specifically about mock fake military exercises with live-fly hijacking exercises and radar inserts?
Yeah. Michael Rupert is one of the great heroes of the 9/11 movement. He was, he was there long before most everybody else was. Paul Thompson's great timeline that got me started, Paul gives Michael Rupert credit, says he got started with Michael. With regard to that particular thesis, it's one that I have not studied sufficiently to have what I would call a really informed opinion on it. It's certainly very interesting that these exercises were going on, but is exactly what role they played that morning, I'm just fairly agnostic. When it comes to Rupert's more particular thesis about Cheney being the one who was in charge that morning and calling the shots, that seems very clear. So we're clearly one on that, and I just say on the other, I think it's probably very significant, but I couldn't say anything more about it.
Okay. Next one, a common question that we conspiracy theorists hear. An inside job of this magnitude involves the conspiracy of a lot of people. How come there is no leak, nobody cracking, nothing? Thank you.
Yeah. Let me say a word about the term conspiracy theory. It's become almost an oath of being an American to say, oh, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. But, of course, your newspaper every day is filled with stories of conspiracies. Whenever two or more people get together to do something illegal or immoral, that's a conspiracy. And if you've got an idea of what happened, you have a conspiracy theory. So we all are believers in conspiracy theories. And the official story about 9/11 is the mother of all 9/11 conspiracy theories. This is the theory that these 19 Arab Muslim hijackers, without any help from anybody in the United States, out-tricked our trillion-dollar military defense system and pulled this off and knocked down these buildings. Well, the question is not whether you believe in a conspiracy theory or not, but which theory stands up to the evidence. Another thing to point out is that as James Fetzer, a philosopher of science, who is now getting involved in the 9/11 truth movement, has pointed out, theory is sometimes a very strong word. We have the theory of gravitation, relativity theory. We have quantum theory. These are very precise theories. The point is they're testable. A conspiracy theory is fine if it's testable. Well, fortunately, the government's theory is testable. You can test. Can steel frame high-rise buildings fall down solely because of fire? And they've actually done experiments to try this, and they've never been able to get a building to even come close to collapsing. So it's a testable theory which has been falsified. And I've indicated several other aspects that are, I think, clear falsifications of the official theory. Now, the question, all sorts of questions can be then raised, sort of a priori questions. Well, why would they do this? And I raise some of those in my book, if you read, chapter 9 of the New Pearl Harbor. There are lots of puzzling questions. I thought the first question was going to be, what happened to Barbara Olson? And that's always the first one. I don't know. There are all of these things. And so is it possible that very many people could be involved in a conspiracy and keep it silent for a long time? Well, yes. Remember the Manhattan Project. A lot of people were involved in that, and that was kept secret for a long time. And we've looked back. Now we know that lots of previous conspiracies were kept silent for a long time. America's first attack in Indonesia, we had a full-scale war going on there. And until a book was published on it in the late 90s, hardly any Americans knew about it. It was kept secret for a very long time. If you add to the fact that we do have other instances, the fact that people, many of the people involved are government or and military and other government employees who take an oath, like these FBI guys. They've taken an oath of obedience. If they violate that, see, they're hoping shippers could, I don't know what's happening now, but originally they were evidently hoping that shippers could get a trial so they could be subpoenaed, in which case they would have to testify, and that would free them from prosecution. But if they just come out and talk, then they're prosecuted, they're sent to prison for the rest of their lives maybe, they can't support their families. And then in some cases, people are told, well, you know, Joe, if you start talking about this, somebody's going to get really mad at you, and I don't know how we're going to protect your wife and kids. Would you talk? Particularly when there's no there's nobody asking you to come forward. Did the 9/11 Commission make a general appeal and say, please, if you've got any information on this, come and talk to us? No, nobody was invited other than government employees. And so if you go to the mainstream media, they ridicule you. So who's going to risk their family's life to come forward? So no, I am not surprised that a rather large number of people could be involved. And also, you know, we have previous examples of things that went on and people who knew got killed. How many in people who apparently had some knowledge about JFK's assassination ended up dead? A lot of people know about that, so they know what can happen. So no, I'm not surprised. But the fact is that, nevertheless, some people are trying to come forward. These FBI agents. Sybil Edmonds has been trying to come forward and tell her story for many, many months now. As I report in my book on the 9/11 Commission report, she testified to the commission for 3.5 hours. She told them very specific things. She's since then written a public letter to an open letter to Chairman Kaine, reminding him of what she told the commission, such as that their Iranian asset had told them that Osama bin Laden, he was an expert on Afghanistan, that Osama bin Laden was planning an attack in the United States pretty soon. The translator who got that information was told to keep quiet within the FBI. She told the FBI about that. That other translator told the FBI in his 2.5 hours of testimony. None of that appears in the 9/11 Commission report. All that you learned that Sybil Edmonds, one tiny little note says that she had some suggestions that FBI should follow its own policies a little more closely. That's all you learned from her 3.5 hours of testimony. So she has been trying to come forward, and some other people too, and they've lost their jobs. So people are.
Okay, here's a question on source validation methodology. Who are your sources, and what standards did you employ to validate these sources?
Yeah, in the New Pearl Harbor, I did rely primarily on the four sources that I cited the most. Nafiz Ahmed's book, but he relied also a lot on Paul Thompson, and also used Michelle Chosdowski, the economist in Canada. Paul Thompson, one thing interesting about his timeline, and now he's published his book as The Terror Timeline, he used only mainline sources. So New York Times, Boston Globe, The Guardian, London Times, and so on. I don't even think he quoted The Nation. I mean, he really stuck to what are considered really mainline sources, and yet found hundreds of stories that contradicted the official account. As to method, you know, it's very partly you just have to learn to trust your kind of educated judgment. I've gotten into a lot of previous fields. My work at the Center for Process Studies called for me to organize conferences in a lot of fields, philosophy of physics, Eastern religions, Chinese religions, Asian, Hinduism, Buddhism, political theory, economic theory. So in each case, I had to go in and start reading around and learning who were the generally considered respectable writers and then who were the ones who maybe weren't so respectable but were good and had something important to say outside the mainstream and so on. So I think method is in that sense more of a sort of trained judgment about these things. And of course, people can differ on these things. But I did, and I limited myself to stories that I found to be at least highly plausible, but I did not commit myself, as those of you who have read the book, to say, I know these stories are true. I mean, there are hundreds of stories there. And a single researcher like myself or Paul Thompson, we don't have the resources. So what we're calling on is we're saying, there is a prima facie case here for a genuine investigation. We've got organizations that have the money to carry out investigations like that. They're called the U.S. Congress. They're called the U.S. media, which have billions of dollars. So the question is, what method are they using? Ignoring.
For what it's worth, David, I handed Senator Russ Feingold your book 2 weeks ago, and he promised to look into it.
I've had a lot of promises. promises.
Okay,
but Russ Feingold is a good guy. I bet he'll do it.
Yeah.
I bet he'll do it.
I actually urged him to take up this in hopes of a Feingold McKinney ticket next election, if there is an election. Okay, where do we go from here? How do we get through to a brainwashed electorate led by money and power?
Next question.
We invite C-SPAN.
Absolutely right. This is really a historic event. You know, when the hearings were being were going on, C-SPAN covered those and covered some of the discussions that occurred afterwards with some of the 9/11 families. And Kyle Hintz of 9/11 Citizens Movement was able to make a statement which C-SPAN did cover, and so that did get conveyed to the American people. But to my knowledge, maybe C-SPAN can correct me, but to my knowledge, this is the first event in which this kind of major presentation, full hour presentation, has been made and covered. So this might be the beginning of something big. We'll see. Just about four more questions.
Okay, we've got room for four more questions at the top of the deck. Specifics. Isn't it true that CIA officials met with Osama bin Laden when he was being operated on in a hospital shortly before 9/11?
This seems to be true. It was reported by a very reputable Swiss journalist and picked up by several European newspapers, including some British newspapers. By just accidentally, I guess, by no American newspaper, but that in July of 2001, when Osama bin Laden was already the number one wanted man in the world, the report is that he went to a hospital in Dubai. The American hospital was treated by an American surgeon and visited by the local CIA agent as well as by the head of Saudi intelligence. So it appears that this is one of the many of the stories I tell in the New Pearl Harbor that suggests that the relationship between the Bush family and the bin Laden family isn't maybe exactly what we've been told. And of course, We have a full-length book on that, House of Bush, House of Sod. And in fact, let me say a word about that. That part of Michael Moore's movie, I'm blanking on the guy's name who wrote House of Bush, House of Sod.
Craig Unger,
yeah. I was very grateful. He corresponded with me on this. And if you remember, after the movie, when Michael Moore's movie got trashed so much by mainline critics, movie critics telling him he didn't know what he was talking about, they said that this idea that any Saudi flights were allowed to go before other flights were allowed to go was just false. And what Craig Unger had reported was that on the September 13th, 2 days after 9/11, there was a flight that took some young Saudis from Tampa to Lexington. And Lexington was one of the places where a big plane was going to take a number of them, bin Ladens and other Saudis, out of the country. And Craig Unger stressed that this flight left before private flights were allowed to go in the United States. Now, he emphasized that at 11 o'clock that morning, American airspace was open to commercial planes, but not to private. And there was a special notice sent out that says this is only for commercial flights. If any private flights go up, they will be forced down. Nevertheless, that flight went at 4:30 that afternoon and was not forced down. They had permission to go. Now, the 9/11 Commission poo-poos that story and says, oh, there was no problem because American airspace was opened at 11 o'clock, deliberately ignoring the distinction Craig Unger made very explicitly, both in his book and in a Wall Street Journal article, the distinction between commercial and private flights. So Michael Moore was right. Craig Unger was right on that.
Short of outright illegal disclosures, will it ever prove possible to create a culture of accountability and transparency with respect to the so-called intelligence community?
Well, many people believe that sort of the beginning of the end of the American Republic happened when the Intelligence Act was created there after World War II, and the CIA was created. Now, it did follow from a previous organization, the OSS, but still it had more powers, and these intelligence agencies now have enormous budgets. There are many of these intelligence agencies, so the CIA is just one of, 11 major intelligence agencies? So you have several, each military branch has to have its own. And so when you talk about what percentage of the American budget goes to military affairs, you know, even the official budget, the official amount is very high. But you really need to factor in a lot of money that is not usually considered military spending. So if you factored in just the budgets for the intelligence agencies, it was an enormous amount. I don't have the exact figure, and nobody does. It's a secret. But people who are in the know speculate that it is a very, very high figure. Well, when you have that kind of money with no accountability, you have, Lord Acton was certainly right. And, you know, he was a good Catholic. He was just carrying out what the Christians have called the doctrine of original sin, which is really the doctrine of originating sin. When he said, and it's very important to get the exact words correctly. It's usually misquoted. But he said, power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. In the second one, no tends to. Absolute power corrupts Absolutely. And we have a military and a set of intelligence agencies now that have virtually absolute power. Thank you very much for coming out on this war meeting. Thank you. Thank you for a great event.